My name's Michael Peters. I'm a New Zealander. I studied English Lit, geography, and discovered philosophy. I was reasonably good at philosophy, so I specialised in that and did a few degrees, my PhD on Wittgenstein, Austrian philosopher who studied under Bertrand Russell at Cambridge. My background, I've moved around quite a lot. I had chairs at Auckland University. I taught at Canterbury in New Zealand. We only have 8 universities. I taught at 4 or 5 of them and went to 3 or 4 of them. So, I know the system pretty well. Then I went to University of Glasgow, followed by the University of Illinois, followed by coming back to New Zealand. Then now I'm at Beijing Normal University, and I've been there for about 18 months, really enjoying it.
Okay, so what's the system like in China? Because for many people, they've never visited China. They think of it as quite authoritarian. So for someone who's a fairly, maybe even pushy, free thinker, how do you find the Chinese system?
I think it's true what they say about authoritarian systems, and the Communist Party in China, which has many millions of members, do exercise a kind of secondary bureaucratic control that really drives me crazy, especially when it comes to the control of information, which is absolutely essential, for the line of work that I'm involved in, because I spend time writing and researching that sort of thing. But it's much freer than we think, and much freer than we think in regard to our own democracies, because I think we need to have a critical look at the way information is distributed by big entrepreneurs and backed by billionaires and so on. Certainly, the message system as it exists in democracy is not like it was in the high point of journalism back, in the post-war period. But let me say that I've just finished writing a book. I've written a book that's been published, The Chinese Dream, and I'm very critical of the Communist Party. They allowed me to publish that. Well, I didn't ask them for permission, but I did get endorsements.
So how do you notice much of a difference between the East and the West in that regard? Because I'm quite certain that there are pressures, particularly through the increasing amounts of money coming from corporate interests into British universities, Western universities generally, that there is a similar kind of pushback there too.
Yeah, no, it's quite interesting because when you talk about information, ultimately you have to talk, in my view, about, first of all, 2 parallel technological systems that don't mesh, right? So you have, of course, the American-based one, which is that adopted by the West in general, and you have the big, news stations and a range of other information channels and so on. And then you have the Chinese one, which are also large oligopoly information service internet companies, So you have Baidu and Tencent, and you have, Bing and a range of other information providers. but these two systems now, in part, worsened by the trade wars, are moving towards their own technological systems. And I think that applies not only to information, but a lot of other things as well, related to information like AI. And let's say we're talking about, a form of computing, organic computing. We're talking about, forms of computing now, which are, experimenting with applying quantum physics in that area, especially for making messages secret and protecting codes and so on. So, the Chinese lead this field, by the way. They lead deep learning, they lead AI, they lead quantum computing, which are also determinants of the infosphere as it's evolving.
So look, we hear this term increasingly, quantum computing. Mm-hmm. Some people say it's actually bunkum. There's no such thing. Can you just take us through what the term means for people that are coming across it for the first time?
Well, you know, when you look at the history of digital logics that originated in Britain, you know, particularly with the algebraification of logic, you know, under a good example is Boolean algebra. You know, it's a two-value logic. It's something that Wittgenstein also contributed to, I might say. And, you know, this was an application in electronics that gave us a two-value logic. And, we had a form of digital logic that enabled the current revolution that takes place. Well, the interesting thing about quantum and quantum physics per se is the notion of positionality and channeling and entanglement, which are three major concepts in relation to quantum theory. And this makes it very difficult to know, not to value, but not only not to value, but it's very difficult to determine where the value exists, you know, in what position.
Seems to me like you're talking about here getting lost in information, where you're actually losing your kind of reference point somehow.
Well, I mean, I think that it's, let's say, first of all, I mean, you know, the claims that are made for quantum computing, as they are made also for fifth and sixth generation mobile technology, is that it's much faster, it's hugely faster, it enables scientists to do certain kinds of calculations in ways that are hugely enhanced from, you know, classical computing. And also, what's more, because of this kind of positionality, it enables codes to be protected. In fact, the corridor between Shanghai and Beijing, where, you know, they are using this technology, is in principle very difficult, you know, to crack, very difficult to hack. So, you know, there are lots of advantages, and it's operational now in some, you know, Google and some of the other large companies have already experimented with working examples.
Okay, so you brought up Google there, an enormously important corporation, a very powerful corporation. They are in the situation now where you're seeing a lot of the Google algorithms are now steering people who are searching towards certain news outlets. In fact, you can even search for a term and it will say there's nothing on the internet where there is. At least that's happened on certain occasions where they've been almost experimenting for a few days with a new algorithm. And they're definitely pushing people towards mainstream news websites now, rather than showing them what their actual search term is in a fair fashion. So with that in mind, I know you've written something recently about fake news. I think it's called Post-Truth.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there are people out there who would love us to live in a post-truth world where whatever they say goes. Mm-hmm. So can you just tell us a little bit about that book? What really made you decide to get involved in exploring that area? Because it's actually very controversial, and there are some very powerful players in that world.
Yeah, well, let's go back a little while to you know, notions of algorithmic and AI intelligence, because, you know, really, you know, there are two forces that shape the social reality that we're living in through at the moment. One, and they're both, let me call it bioinformationalism. It's a combination of biology, new biology, genetics, codes that are discoverable through bioinformatics. You know, if we didn't have the information application to looking at genomics, and, you know, we wouldn't have been able to do much of this work. So, you know, new biology on the one hand, and by that I mean, you know, the kind of revolution that took place, not just with Craig Venter, you know, discovering new forms, you know, synthetic life, basically, several, you know, 5 years ago, 5-7 years ago, through the application of information technology through a kind of system that enabled the writing of DNA code, you know, 3 million letters long, you know, which was impossible for human beings to do this, right? So you have, you know, and, you know, this new piece of DNA was placed in a host bacterium that enabled replication, self-replication to take place, a form of synthetic life. You know, that whole revolution in new biology, and its coalescing power with information technology. So the new force here, combination, is bioinformation, and bioinformationalism records the effects of the accumulative effect of two major forces that are shaping our world. You know, I could go on more on that, but let's come back to Google and your question, because, you know, it's quite clear now that, you know, algorithms can be used for social and political purposes to exclude some stories, to focus on others. I mean, one simply needs to know how search engines operate to get some clue about that. And there have been studies done that show that, you know, this new algorithmic information reality is quite biased. It's capable of bias. And we've had, let's put it this way, we've had now major companies using algorithms that know us better than we know ourselves. They can tell us in a graphic way, through various health apps, for instance, how many beats a minute our heart records on a daily, on a weekly, on a monthly basis. It's information, data, that we don't hold in our heads, but we have access to, but then we trade that, without informed consent, that personal data.
So hang on. Yeah. How is the internet, or how is anybody getting hold of that data?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you participate in these sites, and one of the things that you don't ever really contemplate or see is the way in which large companies steal that data, steal that personal data. They steal it, and they use it, and they use it to then craft a psychology and a product that operates at a kind of tacit and psychological level. So it's extremely dangerous and gives a lot of power. As we know, within the system of democracy, the way in which our democratic processes have been eroded through large info service companies like Google that operate without kind of in a sort of transnational way, without any home in any one country. So, you know, I think it's extremely dangerous. And there have been lots of people who want to, complain about, let's call it surveillance capitalism, or, you know, various terms that are used to talk about the asymmetries of power between large information companies and their millions and millions of global subscribers.
What about the really big companies, though? I mean, we're talking about the media moguls, the media giants, people with massive amounts of reach. Every night, for example, NBC, CNN, these people influencing people. Now, they are the first people to accuse others of fake news, but they surely are vulnerable to it themselves.
Of course. I mean, you know, you don't really have to go too much into the technicalities of new technologies to talk about bias in the news. I mean, I think it's systematically there. You know, you look at what publishing policies are, you look at the nature of plagiarism and libel law and how that operates, the precedents that have been established and that sort of thing. And that's why I say, you know, compared to China, yeah, we think that we're free, but ultimately we're not free. You know, it's a legal question. Freedom is a legal question, you know, about what you can publish, what you can say, and you know, the concept of freedom of information that really, you know, got going in the 70s and then became enshrined in law in most of the democracies during the 80s and 90s and 2000s, you know, ultimately, you know, is an expression of how to control this bias of the large corporation against the individual and the safeguarding of individual information rights, you know, privacy, you know, confidentiality and so on.
For a lot of people, they've basically given up on privacy. They're saying, well, you know, everyone else is being snooped on. Why am I special? I'm not special, so I may as well not make too much of a fuss about it.
Well, yeah, sure. But, you know, you've got Snowden, who, you know, some years ago now revealed the operation of Five Eyes, you know, movement, surveillance. You know, so here in New Zealand, we talk about, the, you know, freedom of information and so on. But, you know, one of the things that he demonstrated was that other countries are a part of that partnership, can surveil your citizens. You don't have to do it yourself, but the consortium can do it for you. And you're not breaking the law. So, you know, the West has got to look very carefully at its own practices before pointing the finger, in my view.
Well, why should people be even concerned that they're under surveillance? Most people, you know, that doesn't even bother them. They've as I said, they've gone past that stage where they really worry about it. They'll send an email, which may be read by somebody. But this, you know, for most people, they just think, well, what's the problem?
Well, I don't know whether they are aware of the way it can shape and manipulate them, but also how it can profile individuals and potentially opposition, you know, and it can provide, let me say, very damning criticism of individuals through acts of association, through, you know, stuff that normally in a democracy is, you know, regarded as sacrosanct, you know. So why should they be worried? Well, I think they should be worried because, you know, it means that the shaping of social reality is in the hands of a few people and they can do whatever they want.
Isn't there a certain degree to which this is a bit of an illusion of the people investing so much in trying to manipulate reality? Actually, reality's out there, and you can't really manipulate it because it's a physical thing that's out there. All you're manipulating is maybe temporarily some people's perception.
Well, I mean, perception is everything in the social media world, right? I mean, you know, if you can create the psychological attitude and set, then you can win elections, or you can dispose of people, or you can encourage certain kinds of policies over others, or you can go to war. I mean, you know, let's talk about the Iraq war in this case. You know, how a set of events is pictured or represented, of course, as it has been since the invention of, you know, kind of representational art, let's say, has a huge effect on you know, human reality. So, you know, I would say perception is everything.
So it allows, actually, I suppose what you're saying is it allows you to see beyond your own horizon. You know, we're sitting here in your room here in Coromandel, and we can see what's around us, but it's all that we can't see beyond that we're talking about, which is what we use to make a lot of our decisions based on. So are we living in a post-truth world? Is truth really in the hands of these mega media corporations now?
Well, you know, it is and it isn't, because, I mean, you know, there are some safety valves. We have, you know, the scientific community, for instance, you know, and it's increasing, and open science, you know, there are huge pressures for scientific communication to be open and to be public. And, you know, over the coronavirus, for instance, in the first few weeks, there's like, you know, 50,000 papers produced, and, you know, they managed to, you know, develop the model of the genome, and they managed to, you know, do a lot of international collaboration and so on. Now, that depended on the free exchange of information, knowledge and data, you know. And globally, I think that's, you know, that's an encouraging sign because that kind of collaboration is growing. So when it comes to, let's say, conspiracy theory, I really put my weight behind, first of all, I choose to believe the scientific story, although it may not always be true. And there are problems about science as well. But put it this way, you know, there is a problem when we think we have free will, you know. And in actual fact, you know, this is systematically and socially constructed reality where we think we're doing something of our own free will. But of course, it has been an exercise in perception management.
Also, I wonder whether maybe quite a lot of effort goes into trying to sort of nudge us in one direction or another direction subconsciously, so we're not even aware. A bit like the advertisers, I suppose, quite famously started to do in the 1950s, 60s, 70s to really get people to buy the product that they didn't need or didn't want. There are ways to do that. You can get under people's skin. So they're making decisions based on something that they're not really aware of. So that's obviously quite dangerous when it comes to things like, you know, elections, when it comes to things like war. There's a lot of power involved in something like that. But I like your ideas about coronavirus, because this is one story, I think, which has got some enormous questions which don't seem to really have been properly addressed by, you know, you're talking about science there. But, you know, one of the weird things about the story, certainly peculiar things, I was just listening to World Update on the BBC World Service earlier, talking about, well, people in Iran believe that this is some sort of attack on their country rather than just a naturally occurring virus, that there's some, in some way it's deliberate. And there are a lot of people in China saying the same. Isn't it interesting how the two big enemies of the United States seem to have suffered most with this apparently natural event? So can you just go into that? And is that going down a really crazy road for those people to be thinking that? Because that's certainly what millions of people in China and Iran are thinking about this virus.
I mean, I think it's not crazy, okay? And it may be true. The other thing, there is a possibility of truth of some of these things. So we have to investigate it. We have to establish what the facts are. And the fact that both the Iranians and the Americans, you know, and the Chinese all have their stories about some other foreign power planting a bug in their country indicates something about the nature, the psychological nature of the virus, i.e. we are the population at large, can start stories and people can believe these stories about where the coronavirus came from. But let's put it this way, my money's behind the science, I've got to say, because, you know, just a cursory glance at the scientific literature of the social impact of, you know, viruses, of epidemics, really, in the 20th century, reveals a kind of scientific track history about death rates, about genomic models, about contagion effects, about a whole range of issues that epidemiologists can understand as a natural etiology or causal history. So, you know, my money's behind the science, but it doesn't mean to say, for instance, that it could be true that some bioweapon lab in some country has invented a virus that can do enormous, you know, human harm. In this case, you know, let's put it this way. It does help to understand something about the nature of viruses. So I go to the science, you know, you go to the evolution of viruses and you know they've been around for a long time, 450 million years. They, you know, the biologists are not sure which came first. Is it a form of life? Yes, but, you know, probably there's a there's a you know, combination of cell and virus that came into being at some point. You know, that's the latest kind of theory about it. So it goes back a long way. There are trillions of viruses. It's probably the most diverse life form, you know, on Earth. There are trillions in the ocean. Let's say, as far as coronavirus is concerned, there is a lot of coronaviruses in mammals and birds. This strain of coronavirus, apparently there are seven major forms. This is the novel virus that has emerged, COVID-19. And, you know, it is also, a rapidly mutating and self-replicating virus. And how we dealt with it, well, you know, it's kind of an interesting experiment. You know, to what extent is this an indication of globalization, of viral and public health management without borders? Well, actually, at a scientific level, it's been pretty good. And I think that, you know, there are lots of criticism in the World Health Organization in terms of public management, done really well. And you've got to steer a course where you avoid the worst panics, but not through suppression of information. And on the other hand, a kind of realist view that can be quite scary, you know, because we're at the very beginning of it. You know, we've just had really only 3 or 4 months. In 3 or 4 months, we've had something in the order of 3,500 to 4,000 people die in China, mostly in China. Now it's the West's turn, and we're in the Middle East. We've got Middle East, we have it in Northern Italy, and so, you know, it's in Europe, it's in the Middle East, probably going to go into Africa, probably going to go into India, probably going to get the South Pacific. When it gets into those third world countries, you know, the contagion effects could be much greater. In my view, you know, we had 4,000, roughly 3,500, 4,000 people die in a 3 to 4 month period. You know, I would say, you know, epidemiological modelling, I'm not an expert, but, you know, 12,000 as a conservative estimate that might die in a year is not far-fetched. And, you know, if it gets into Africa and these other third world countries, then it could be a lot more, could be a factor of 3 increase.
But I mean, we step back from the coronavirus story for a minute.
Yeah.
There's 500,000 people, mostly elderly people, every year dying of ordinary flu.
Yeah, well, that's another virus, of course. One of the things we want to prevent, you know, through these new public health practices is this new virus establishing itself endemically, so it's with us for here.
How do you think the Chinese have done? There's been some criticism and some praise for China. I mean, I was amazed to see the way that they were, for example, if you order a pizza, you can still order a pizza in China, and if you order a pizza, the pizza turns up with a certificate of the body temperature of the person who made the pizza, the body temperature of the person that packs the pizza, yeah. And the body temperature at the time it's delivered of the person who's delivering you the pizza, which I think is quite an incredible bit of bureaucracy. But I don't imagine you could successfully do that in the West, but they've managed to do it in China. Anyway, what's your thoughts about the way that the Chinese government have dealt with it?
I mean, I think they had some hiccups at the beginning, you know, the suppression of information, wanting to close down information that they thought was harmful, and I don't know what level within the Communist Party those directives came from, but clearly, you know, that was a mistake. That was a huge mistake, and the young doctor who exposed the story died, you know, for his efforts, you know, to protect the public. But since then, the Chinese have been very successful in isolating, you know, at social confinement through the process of kind of street level quarantine, and that's been effective because the number of people dying from the disease now has plateaued, is declining. I don't know whether that means that the China phase is over and the West phase is about to begin. I don't know whether we can really safely assume that, but let me say, you know, We have actually not too much in terms of quarantine has changed since the way the, you know, in the Middle Ages, plague towns, so-called plague towns, dealt with the bubonic plague. That's not a virus. It's a bacterium. But it was an epidemic that killed, you know, tens of millions of people. And, you know, it was managed through the process of quarantine, through a hierarchical process which established registrations at the street level, you know. And, you know, you go back and read the regulations in the Middle Ages, and it's a technology of social segmentation, social confinement, and you know, bring out your dead and dispose of them, and you know, protect people from one another, and until you can ascertain, you know, until the virus, you know, or the bacterium actually burns itself out. But you know, in that case, we've had many, haven't we, in the 20th century? Spanish flu early on that killed tens of millions. We had the Asian flu, we had the bird flu, we had, you know, and some of these, SARS itself, which is, you know, very similar genetically to this, 60 to 70% in common, you know, SARS, I think, killed 744. And, you know, I think the Asian flu was like 18,000. So my estimate is for this one, if we get it under control, and the way that the Chinese managed to get it under control in the last 2 or 3 months in China, we're looking at maybe 12,000. You know, but I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm just making a rough estimate of what I think might happen.
I mean, picking up on what you're saying about Italy, this is an interesting case in obviously the biggest coronavirus problem in Europe. But having spoken to people in the Milan region over the last couple of days, there's apparently been a complete what they've tried to call isolation of however many million people in northern Italy. Now, 11 million. So my correspondent tells me, well, actually, they haven't really quarantined these people. They've just closed things like hospitals and schools. Now, obviously, some of the hospitals are open for treating people for this, but they're saying, for whatever you do, if you think you've got the symptoms of coronavirus, don't visit your doctor, don't visit your GP, etc. Yeah. So, but what he's saying is that, well, because all the schools are closed, all the young people, I mean, we're talking tens of thousands, possibly millions of young people, are just getting together in different parts of town, in places like shopping centres, etc. So there is no effective, real quarantining of people. And my correspondent was saying, well, this is just a media exercise, really. What are your thoughts about that? Because, again, we're talking here about something which is, you know, for most people listening to this, thousands of miles away in Italy, we're being told X. We speak to somebody who's very close to what's happening on the ground. They tell us why. So is there really quarantine going on in Italy, as we're being told by the news media, or not?
Well, this comes back to the difference between, you know, democracies on the one hand and authoritarian states on the other. You know, when Chinese do social confinement, you know that it happens, you know, because the ultimate penalty is, you know, so great, you know, and the policy is accompanied by punishment if you don't accept it. In social democracies like Italy and America, let's say, I doubt very much whether the state has the power to enforce its own kind of regulations when it comes to, on the one hand, you know, the systematic nature of testing that's required, for instance. I doubt whether the United States has even begun that process in any systematic way. As far as Italy is concerned, well, of course, here again, the perception is everything. And, you know, and I notice, you know, New Zealand has only 5 cases, but one of those cases was somebody who came from Italy. And they went into a clinic that said very clearly on the front, do not enter. this clinic if you have been overseas in Italy or Iran. And we had also one case from Iran that came from Iran. Now, neither of those people who, you know, they have name suppression here, obeyed the confinement, you know, policy. And so I think you do have, I mean, let me say, does this come down to a difference about the obedience of citizens in times of crisis? Well, I don't really know about that question, but let me put it this way. I think it's much harder to enforce these regulations in a democracy than it is in a one-party state.
Okay, so conspiracy theories. I know you've done specific work on what they are. With something like coronavirus, we've got a practical living example right now as we're talking. This is a global, it's probably the biggest story of 2020 so far. How do you go about looking at that information, sifting it for yourself? How can people, you know, listeners, just figure out which of the various theories floating around is a conspiracy theory and which can be taken seriously? Because we do seem to have moved to a point in the West, particularly for youngsters in our education system, where there isn't so much of an emphasis on critical thinking and on picking up on the various different, you know, possibilities that this may be a lie, probably in the last 30, 40 years, since a lot of the kind of commercialisation of education we've got in the UK, we've got these academy school systems, privately run schools, and there doesn't seem to be that rigorous, you know, when I was brought up in the 60s and 70s of, you know, really pushing critical thinking hard. So how do we go when it comes to coronavirus about seeing the wood for the trees?
Well, yeah, that's a great question, Tony, because, I mean, I agree with you. You know, actually, the privatisation of education and its vocationalisation, you know, and its attempt at various levels really to emphasise the STEM subjects and not history or politics or philosophy, you know, that's a real problem. And how does that come out? It manifests itself in a democracy when people are uncritical and they accept what they're told on the media. Actually, in some sense, let me say, also, it's grounds for the kind of scepticism that is involved with the development of conspiracy theory, you know, let me say, in the worst possible way, the flat earthers, the fact that nobody really walked on the moon, you know, the palpably false conspiracy theories, you know, in science, you know, the anti-vax. We had a big story about the anti-vax in South Pacific, in Samoa, you know, 850 kids died because they weren't vaccinated. So, you know, and let's put it this way, among the bourgeoisie, among the middle classes, there is also this new kind of mysticism, you know, filtrated through new cults and forms of Eastern philosophy and other, let me say, false Eastern philosophy, where the reasonably well-educated are believing in anti-science conspiracies, fluoride in the water, all this kind of thing. I find it among my own friends, you know. It's very, very worrying. And you know, although I think that the scepticism is healthy, but it's misdirected into some appallingly, obviously bad, you know, false stories.
So look, let's just take a step back for a second. Because, of course, for most people looking at these conspiracy theories and wondering about, well, is in the back of their mind, and in the back of my mind, I have to say, is sometimes, well, why would someone bother to make that up? Can you answer that question?
Well, I mean, there are, of course, examples of conspiracy theories that are designed to be toxic and harmful to certain individuals, for people who are running for parliament, or, you know, running in politics, or for business reasons. You want to damage the opposition, or, you know, the opposition's product. you want to raise some doubts about this new product or whatever. So, you know, the deliberate nature of some conspiracy theories are highly damaging. But I don't hold with some philosophers that conspiracy is irrational, but it can really it can create a lot of damaged human beings, particularly, you know, when it talks about news stories about coronavirus. You know, where it discourages people from doing certain kinds of things. Like, for instance, if there was a story that went round, I don't know whether there are, there are bound to be some stories like this, about anti-vaccination. We don't have a vaccination yet, although Imperial College London seems to be pretty well on the track, but, you know, animal and human testing is going to take another year before we get something that's manageable. But in the process, of course, the anti-vaxxers are going to object to that. They don't put a needle in your body for this, because their conspiracy is that, well, who knows? Who knows what it is?
I'll tell you what their conspiracy is. And their conspiracy is this is just being something which is just being produced for profit. And the more that company can say, well, we've managed to find the vaccine first, the more profit for their shareholders.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, there is a huge amount of money to be made here, and the pharmacological companies are very, very much aware of that. And you have teams in Australia and Britain and Australia, you know, America and China, of course, who are working on hoarding information and knowledge in order to produce the vaccine that's going to be worth billions.
In fact, I could say, if I was a confidential advisor to the board of GlaxoSmithKline or something, then, well, hang on, I've just manufactured this virus. If you can, I'll give it to you first, or I'll sell it to you first, and you can manufacture a virus antidote or whatever, a vaccine for it, and then we'll spread it out amongst the public, and when it starts to, you know, kill lots of people, then you can be the first to be the ones to sell the back. I mean, the thing is, we don't have, I mean, there's no moral necessity on someone not to do that, and in a big corporation, particularly a multinational corporation, not to accept that. The other thing is, I've heard as a, I think, an interesting little conspiracy theory to do, and it may be some truth to it, who knows, to do with coronavirus, is that the Chinese have inflicted this deliberately on themselves, because it is a bioweapon, and this is, I'm not saying it is, I'm saying this is part of the theory, but that the Chinese population will be the most resistant to it, because they would have built up resistance. So there's all sorts of directions that one can go down, and one does wonder whether this is, it's not just a little virus, a minuscule little thing which is being passed between people, but it's also a kind of news virus too, an informational virus.
Yeah, no, I think, well, actually, you put your finger on it here, because when you talk, the concept I use is viral modernity, because we're not only talking about viruses in the physical, in terms of an infective agent, you know, at the physical level, but also talking about epidemics and infodemics, you know. And infodemics have two sides to them. They can be true or they can be false. And when you talk about critical education, and you talk, we have to be able to determine which ones are false and which ones are true. Much harder to determine the truth ones, the ones that are truthful, because it takes a lot of time and testing and accumulation of fact and cross-checking and so on and so on. It's probably easier to eliminate the false ones, but that takes a lot of time as well. But, you know, the way in which infodemics, I mean, can be extremely damaging to the population, because coming back to your example about Glaxo, let's say, for instance, an example, I don't think anybody's going to put a false vaccine out there, but they may make some horrendous claims, I'm waiting for this, about maintaining health in a time of viral, you know, viral scare. And if you do this and you take these, you know, immune boosters, can you imagine the number of health products that go on the market that are aimed at, you know, establishing a healthy immune system that can resist viruses. Well, we're going to get a whole bunch of that stuff, you know. And
well, actually, vitamin C is apparently quite good for your, and vitamin D quite good for your immune system, and that's sort of freely available. Hopefully, not patented.
True. Yeah, there are a lot of. I mean, you know, I think that's probably true, and there are a lot of folk remedies out there as well. I guess if I rubbed your back with garlic, you know, that might help as well.
Not right now.
Okay. But, you know, we do. I put my money behind the science, and, you know, I think that's a very difficult process. We have to show kids growing up, you know, who being educated in schools, that scientific method. You know, it differs as a, you know, quite a variant kind of thing. But when we're talking about experimental control groups and so on, there's a lot of testing involved, and it takes a long time. You know.
Okay, so let's finish off by talking a bit about climate change, because I notice here in New Zealand there's a much more sceptical attitude. Certainly there's a lot of scepticism in the UK, but most of the mass media seems to be pretty much, and the government too, pretty much behind, well, we've got to get rid of petrol, we've got to get rid of all fossil fuels. The elephant in the room, of course, is nuclear, which is amazing to see environmentalists sort of sidestepping that one. But anyway, what do you make of some of the post-truth, climate change? Is it really man-made from your point of view?
Well, I mean, I think let's put it this way, some very unfortunate occurrences of scientific fraud that's taken place with climate change. So much is at stake. What's at stake? Well, if you have a look at the world economy and you look at the Forbes top 500 companies, they're oil and gas. Well, we're talking trillions of dollars that are involved in investments in the Arctic now by Russia, and, you know, for gas pipelines and a whole range of things, you know, planning into the next 10, 20 years. You know, there's a lot of money involved here. Now, and I think also with managed funds, you see the effects of shareholders who are saying we're not going to accept further investment in these kinds of activity. Now, in terms of New Zealand, you know, our sceptical attitudes here, I think, you know, there is a very strong green lobby. We have a coalition, Green, you know, Green is part of the Labour coalition in government at the moment. We have, I think, a lot of green activists here. We have some, you know, we have a strong conservation, you know, lobby. And I think, you know, but at the same time, the pressure on some scientists have led them to falsify data and results in favour of showing climate warming. Well, they don't do themselves any service by doing that. And then being discovered, but at the same time, you might say there are millions of dollars going into climate change denial, being sponsored by the big multinationals that have most of gain here. So you know it is an extremely difficult question to resolve. And I think you know this, in my view, and I've written an article called "Ecologies of Fire." That I wrote from this little house in Tairua when the Australian fires were raging at a great intensity, and the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Moe, was denying, as a Liberal politician, that it had anything to do with climate change. Now, I mean, subsequently, the scientific consensus was slow to emerge that higher than average temperatures do create certain conditions within which, you know, these raging infernos actually are sustained. And, you know, I could taste it on my tongue here, the smoke from the Australian fires, and it ended up on, you know, on New Zealand glaciers, you know. So, you know, it does really indicate the global nature of these climatic and ecological systems. At the same time, I know that fire by local Aboriginals was a means for preserving biological biodiversity and so on. Having researched that, you can easily establish that's the case.
I noticed a piece on the New Zealand news here about some fire brigade here somewhere in New Zealand, in a way demonstrating that actually fire can be used to form breaks between areas of potentially, like, tinder dry, which at another time of the year might be tinder dry woodland. Yeah. And yet this was kind of poo-pooed at the time of the Australian fires, saying, well, this is, the government apparently in Australia had cut back doing this.
Yeah.
And there it was just literally a few weeks ago in February, March 2020, we're seeing it on the New Zealand TV, the New Zealand fire crews demonstrating, well, actually, if you really want to stop fires spreading, when it gets really dry, when it's not too dry, you need to do these fire breaks, basically, for burning fire breaks.
Yeah,
this was cut back in Australia. We know this as a fact. This is not made up. Whatever government cutbacks, they stopped doing this for whatever reason.
Yeah.
The other thing they were doing was doing a lot of diverting of water to irrigating plantations, and even large rivers were drying up as a result in Australia. So there's definitely been some sort of man-made, this isn't necessarily the atmosphere doing this. This is commercial pressure of whatever sort, one from the government, one from these commercial growers, to change the landscape, to actually drain water out of the landscape, to make it more vulnerable to these sorts of wildfires. Now, I'm not saying that the climate change has not had any effect on it, but these things seem to be, if you even such so much as raise these issues, you're a climate change denier.
Yeah, this is, this polarization is not good for science either, really. I mean, even though, there have been lots of international panels and that sort of thing. I mean, it's clear that commercial decisions and government decisions and and the human ecology of the infosphere are part of the emerging kind of ecology that we're talking about in relation to climate change.
Now, one of the things you've brought up, which I don't think we hear anywhere really generally, is the immense financial power of the energy industry generally. So of course there is a lobby there which is hardly really being mentioned. But anyway, look, I think we should wind up now. And if you could just point listeners towards maybe one or two of the books you think would be most relevant to people, particularly people who are interested in, skeptical about our news media, skeptical about media generally, and are critical thinkers like many of the listeners are.
Okay, so I would direct your listeners to one book called Post Truth and Fake News, which is an edited collection mostly by philosophers and educators and so on. That was published in 2018. It's a Springer book, and if you're interested in the viral take on it, I'm associated with the concept of bioinformationalism. It's a little article that appears in a journal called Thesis 11. It's a straight-in one, which is about that. And there's another journal called Educational Philosophy and Theory, which is publishing a story called Viral Modernity, which is an analysis of the effects of bioinformationalism. And let me say, as an aspect of, the way the world is today,
Okay, what about you? Can people follow you, your work online or social media, that sort of thing?
Yeah, they can. I edit a journal called Educational Philosophy and Theory. It's the leader in the field. It has a pretty high impact factor. Not that that's a big deal, but it's the editorials are free and I think also, as I said to you earlier, I have a kind of like a web presence. I've written, God knows why, 220 books or whatever, hundreds of articles. So the people should not have any difficulty cottoning on.
What about sort of these things like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, these kind of things?
Yeah, I do. I do Twitter, and I send out Twitter accounts. I've done a lot of sort of videos. I haven't really worked on Instagram yet.
Well, this is for the youngsters, I think.
maybe, but yeah, I'm pretty old in the tooth. But I'm trying to keep up with the innovation that's taken place.
Okay, so just remind us of your name and that book you mentioned.
Yeah, no, my name is Michael Peters, and the book is called Post Truth and Fake News, and the subtitle is Viral Modernity in Higher Education.
Mike, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure. It's been an interesting conversation.